we will dive into those as well. And as usual, Jason, just, you know, if it's not a question you're interested in, just say pass. We have tens and tens of thousands of questions, so we won't run out of them. Love to get your questions from those of us, those who have joined us today. I wanted to also remind you, we are going to record the session, put it up on our podcast platform. And yeah, so I know Scott has a question because he always does. So see if he will raise his hand and come on up and join us. But otherwise, I will dive in with a question here that I think is pretty much up your alley. Is cancel culture the new authoritarian regime?
Right. Well, first we have to sort of, define our terms and be very clear what we mean by cancel culture. Because I think when we talk about cancel culture, a lot of people say, oh, cancel culture has always been around. And it seems to me that the absence of a specific definition leads many of us to talk past each other. So my understanding, given that it has so many different iterations of cancel culture, is the willful intent. There are two fundamental attributes I want to define it by and then answer the question. It is the willful intent to punish or penalize someone for a viewpoint that lies outside, and this is going to sound vague, but whatever lies outside received wisdom or the orthodoxy that has been sort of a set of premises, a set of beliefs, a set of ideas that get codified as cultural norms to which we are expected to adhere. All persons are expected to adhere. The latest one, of course, being that people can change their sex or change their genders, and the two are used interchangeably. And anyone who disputes that is punished, and the punishment can take various forms. So the first attribute of cancel culture I sort of would define as the willful intent to silence and or to punish persons whose express viewpoint deviates from received wisdom or the orthodoxy of those who take themselves to be the vanguards of our culture in any sphere. And the second attribute I would associate with cancel culture has to do basically with, let me use my words very carefully here, denying from admission into the realm of knowledge any evidence that could dispute that which is taken to be an unassailable truth or a set of unassailable truths. So I think the two go hand in hand, because for cancel culture to work, you have to make sure that you close the gates, that you close the knowledge realm, that you bar truth and that you bar the criteria that are used to adjudicate disputing truth claims, which are reason and logic, in order that the codified cultural norms or mores or norms can take ascendance in the culture. So that's probably not an exhaustive definition, but that would be my thin or skeletal definition of cancel culture. Now, to answer your question, is it the new form of authoritarianism? I think yes and no, in the sense that we're still living in a free society in which, so let's be clear, people's careers have been ruined by cancel culture. People have been fired. Whether one is an advocate of or a supporter of Chris Cuomo or not, we saw where CNN fired him because of an allegation made by an anonymous woman who claimed that he was guilty of sexual misconduct towards her. And so he was, in effect, people would use the word, he's been canceled. I mean, we know that he was fired, but he was canceled because part of what constitutes cancel culture today is that the anonymous viewpoints of a person or the opinions of a person are both necessary and are sufficient, I should say, to penalize that person without any kind of forthcoming evidence. The person is presumed guilty and not innocent. And that's another probably attribute I would ascribe to or impute to cancel culture, is that persons are assumed not guilty until proven innocent, but guilty until they can prove their innocence, which is typically a non-American way. So the reason I say yes and no is because we still live at least in a semi-free society in which there can be rejoinders, there can be counterfactuals, there can be claims that dispute that which counts as received wisdom, that which counts as the codified, unassailable truths that others have put forward without any evidence, just a declaration of their feelings. We still live in a society where people have access to legal resource. They can claim it. They can test it. People or newspapers are still, and our online fora are still free for us to express our opinions without any kind of reprisal from the government or the state. So there is no official censorship in the strict definition that, let's say, Rand would define censorship as. There's self-censorship and there is big tech, in quote, censorship, but I'm not sure that that really constitutes censorship. So I said yes, in the sense that real lives are destroyed by a kind of authority that these codified norms and customs and principles and mores seem to occupy in our culture. So one could say, you know, Rand wants to define the age as the age of envy. We could, in a sort of colloquial way, say we live in the age of cancel culture. So yes, in that sense, but no, in the sense that if we look at how authoritarianism behaves in authoritarian societies like Singapore or North Korea, those who are the victims of cancel culture would have no ability or capacity to challenge and to fight the accusations or the viewpoints that they hold. And we still have that in America. So it's not a definitive answer that I'm giving, but that's the best I can do.
I think that is really helpful. So it's authoritarian and it's pervasive, but it would probably not be correct to call it a regime because it's not governmental.
That's right. That's right. It's more cultural and a loose, which it is not to say that it doesn't wield an enormous of nefarious power, but it is more a cultural phenomenon rather than a phenomenon that is unilaterally backed up by the state.
Right. Jay LaPere, chairman of the board of the Atlas Society.
Thank you.
Has nothing better to do, so he's joining us.
No, I love these and love your answer there, Jason. That was terrific. I did want to elevate what I'll call the tribal loyalty to the narrative point that I think you're making with respect to the culture itself, but then ask if you might link it to the question of, since there's no truth, no objective reality as part of what drives much of this thinking, does it mean that we really deal with ideas as not true or false, but good or evil, and evil ideas need to be suppressed, and facts and objective truth, any of that is irrelevant because of the oppressor oppressed narrative. And then all those who are on board everyone who's part of our tribe needs to be on board and never question, or you'll get the same treatment. I assume that's all connected in some pretty deep way here. And then I had a second question that's unrelated to this, but I was reading a book, which I think is fantastic, and I had a question on it.
Okay, so let me ask. Yeah, the first part, that's why I said there, it's twofold. That is, that it's the willful attempt to keep out of the, not what I call the knowledge realm or the realms of knowledge, the truth, which constitute canceling out philosophical meaning tests or any kind of meaning tests that have methodologies behind them for helping us to arrive at the truth. Yes, I completely agree. Cancel culture is primarily concerned, or the practitioners of cancel culture, I'd say, are primarily concerned with feelings as and emotions as both tools of cognition and also as sufficient conditions for shutting down people's lives. That is, if my feelings are hurt, or if my opinion, or if your opinion offends my opinion, that's a sufficient condition to shut you down. So yes, I completely agree. We all have philosophical meaning tests, scientific meaning tests that we marshal when we are appraising truth claims. So we know that when people make utterances, that there are objective criteria that we can appeal to appraise the argument, and the better argument wins because it has a better fit with reality. And so those truth claims, I'm sorry, those meaning tests themselves have to correspond to something very, very real. The purveyors or the practitioners of cancel culture want to bypass that and simply use their feelings and their unsubstantiated opinions, which are beliefs, as unassailable, as immutable. Yeah.
Jason, before you get to Jay's second question, could you also tap on me and make me a moderator?
Okay.
Great. Okay. Thanks.
There you go.
Yeah. The second question, Jason, in your book, which reminded me so much of why I fell in love with objectivism as I was reading the first part of your new book, you raise the question the point that this was the founding of America was a revolution in epistemology that linked into politics. How do you deal with what I'll call the fiction of the concept of the governed? You know, we've dealt with anarchism. Rand was she dismissed, the libertarians because of the anarchist influence and maybe because of libertine, ethical outlooks. But I think anarchism was a huge part of her objection to libertarianism, way back. That consent of the governed is a fiction, and the purpose of government to protect liberty, you have to have a monopoly on force. It has to be. Any moral approaches to that you would say are the stronger statements, or is that something you would say is just outside of what you've spent much time on?
No, when I teach a course called The History of European Political Thought, and we start with Hobbes, and really it's a history on it's social contract theory, looking at the beginnings of liberalism after the collapse towards the collapse of feudalism. And one of the questions that the students often ask me is, I didn't choose to be here. I was born in this society. And so I didn't ratify the social contract that subjects me. I'm not a signature of the social contract. So why do I have to obey the laws? And the more ethical upshot of the response, to keep it short, is something on the order of, well, one of the beautiful things about political liberalism, there are many things problematic about political liberalism, but one of the beautiful things about political liberalism is that it has an exit clause. That is, you are free to exit the state. So your ensconcement, your personal ensconcement, your personal stance in the state is a tacit agreement that you give to be subjected to objective, rational laws that protect your inalienability, the inalienability of your rights, the inviolate dignity that you possess. And so the fact that you haven't taken advantage of, and I think this is a big thing in political liberalism, that you haven't taken advantage of the exit clause. Socrates, and I go back to Socrates, you know, Socrates made that argument in, not the Apology, what's the text after the Apology? I teach that text so often, where he has a chance to escape Athens. And he does not. And he says, I chose to remain in the state. Therefore, my mere presence means that I've endorsed, in some sense, the laws that govern me, whether I agree with them or disagree with them, or disagree with them or agree with them. So I think in some sense, that is the response that I would give. That is... once you choose to remain within the liberal order, your consent is tacit and then very, very real. I wouldn't give the Kantian order that answer that you have duties to yourself for many, many reasons. I would prefer to just keep it really thin and skeletal and say that in not taking advantage of the exit clause, you subject yourself voluntarily, not to all laws, because there are we have a theory of civil disobedience within political liberalism, and we do have the right to disobey unjust laws. But your mere existence and your agreement to stay within the geographic boundary in which you're born is a tacit endorsement of the state to govern you by objective, rational laws that protect your inalienability, and among other things that are consonant with your nature as a rational human being. If the government abrogates all of that, then of course you have the right to object, and you have the right to even disobey an unjust law through acts of civil disobedience.
Right. No, that's terrific, and it links directly to free speech and to the right of exit. Yep. Yeah. Thank you.
Also, Jason, Professor Stephen Hill is driving, so can't unmute himself, but he says the piece of writing you might be looking for is Crito?
The Crito, oh my God, the Crito, yes, yes, yes. I just taught it in the spring in my intro, my honors class, so yeah. Thanks, Stephen, yes, yes, the Crito, where he explains to Crito, who wants him to escape, and he steadfast refuses. Thank you, the Crito, which is the follow-up text of the Apology, yeah.
Scott.
Hi there. Good stuff so far. I wanted to ask you, Professor Hill, I know you've been also, the cancel culture has come after you, whether it was people claiming, you know, you didn't like trans people or Palestinian people. And it just seems like part of it is, you know, that's what they do. They accuse us of being bigots, which is basically the worst charge you can have today. And they'll find some way to do it. But, you know, there's only like so many things we can get really worked up about. And I feel like the liberty movement should push back on people falsely using that charge. And to the extent we don't, we're sanctioning it and encouraging it more. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, yes, thanks, Scott. I think that's right. And to pick up on something that you're saying about when they falsely accuse us, they can only do that because moral relativism is the governing norm in terms of, you can't even say adjudicating among truth claims. Moral relativism is just the, in quote, ethical norm that prevails. That is that, among other things, you know, each culture is the author and sovereign creator of its own truth, or in the subjective form of relativism, that every opinion has equal value and equal worth and equal purchase on the truth. So the village idiot who wants to elevate his sophomoric high school opinions to the level of human knowledge, his opinions are just as valid as someone who has used empirical evidence, reason, logic to justify a claim that he or she has made. So I think to get real philosophical, one of the reasons that they can accuse us of being bigots is because their opinions don't have to be substantiated. Well, opinions can't be substantiated because opinions are unsubstantiated beliefs by definition. So their claims or their utterances don't have to be substantiated by any factual or evidentiary method because, according to cultural relativism, among other things, there are no objective criteria to adjudicate among truth claims. And truth claims here I'm using as opinions that people have, like I'm a Palestinian hater, I hate Arabs, right? Or because I say that men should not be competing, biological men who identify as trans women should not be competing in sports that are the realm or the biological women. So I just get called a bigot, and that sort of sticks. Why? Because we've dispensed with the criteria that really are responsible for determining sex. It's not genitalia, really. It's chromosomal markers. And those you cannot change. Science has not come up with a way to change chromosomal markers. But in most people's minds, it's kind of a magical thinking. We don't have to take science seriously. Why? Because science is also a racist, subjective set of hypotheses by people who wield discursive power in the world. So there are all these canards and all these false beliefs that are left unchallenged that make it possible for something like cancel culture. What we need to really do is to among other things, there's nothing simple about this, but is to assert the primacy of reason and assert the primacy of logic as the only methods for adjudicating. I won't include empirical evidence because if you're a rational person, you know when to include, you know, when empirical evidence is necessary. As the only arbiters of adjudicating among truth claims and at arriving at something like the truth. I mean, short of physical violence, which does not prove that one is wrong, and which I certainly am not an advocate of, it's like enforcing the rules of grammar, or like when you learn a foreign language and the teacher enforces the rules. We just have to enforce the rules that give us purchase on the truth, some purchase, or give us an exclusive access to the truth in whatever realm we're dealing with. We just have to be consistent and not yield one inch to the radical subjectivists who are moral relativists, really.
Roger.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Hill, this is a pleasure. Every time I get to see you on this app, I enjoy the opportunity to have an exchange with you. I have purchased your book, not just for myself, but as Christmas gifts for family. So I appreciate you putting the work into that. A question that I have for you is, I get in a lot of conversations here on the Clubhouse app and talking about the value of liberty and how that virtue is more important than the idea of equality, and that equality is this elusive thing that we'll never get to, but liberty is this ideal that we should strive for. And what strikes me as odd is how hard it is to convince people of the importance of liberty. And I'm wondering, you know, from your experience in teaching, how do you reach people on the concept of liberty and break through the noise that's out there and beat down these narratives that seem to be destroying us? I'm just looking for extra arrows for my quiver when it comes to communicating the point of the importance of liberty and how we can be more persuasive and get people to value some of the lessons that we learned through the Age of Enlightenment.
Thanks, Roger. Well, the first thing about equality is that, and Rand, I think, made a great, great point about this. It's going to take the spectacle of massive kind of suffering. And by that, I mean the consequences of evading the very means that you need to survive long term as a human being for things to restore, things to be restored. And things will never be restored fully. Things are never ever restored fully. I think that's too demanding a criterion. Things, even, you know, when Rand was writing, she thought that the culture was bankrupt, that we're heading towards the collapse of the Roman Empire, analogously speaking, that we're heading towards Rome and the collapse of Rome. And she could be quite apocalyptic, and with good reason. But I don't think that things have to be perfect. I think, for me at least, Jennifer, one of the beauty of living in the midst of this chaos that we're living in, and a lot of it is chaos, is that there still is no official censorship, right? When there is a censorship, when the government, who has a coercive monopoly on the use of force, begins to criminalize thought and dissent and actually start putting people in jails and shutting down social media or newspapers, then it's time for another Tea Party. But we're not there. We're not there. And so long as people have the freedom to build new universities, as they are certainly building, new academies, so long as we have the freedom to say, you're wrong, and here's why I think you're wrong, and consistently employ those philosophical meaning tests or scientific meaning tests or whatever meaning tests are suitable for the dispute at hand, there is still hope. And and we see remnants, we see signs of this in a semi-free society or a free society. I still think we're a free society. But I don't know that we have to have an utter economic collapse. Quite the opposite. I think if we had an utter economic collapse, it would just give the socialists room to move in and to really fully take over and establish a socialist regime, which is really what the left, the radical, the far left is after. But to answer the question, no, I don't think that it takes a complete economic breakdown for us to have some sort of restorative appreciation of our society.
Yeah, a new beginning. And I think the second part that you mentioned is especially important. We can look at places where these ideas have been enacted and they have led to utter ruin. Venezuela, Cuba. Mm-hmm. It becomes almost, you know, impossible to come back when you have a new regime that's in place that is just not going to give up power under any condition. So, Monica, love your profile pic. I completely agree with it. You have a question for Professor Hill?
Thanks, Jennifer, and thanks, Professor Hill, for your time. I'm learning about you, and I'm so excited to learn about people that are going in the direction that I think our country needs to go in. I'm reminded about the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. And I believe we're living in quite interesting times, but it is a little fatiguing. So my two questions are, how you said we will have to go through discomfort for us to go through it to get to the other side. How can we buffer against the pain of the people, from the people who are not paying attention? Because I think a lot of people aren't paying attention. And then when you receive personal slights because you don't think, you don't have a homogeneous thought process as I do, and I, you know, the sense, the verbal slings and arrows, how do you handle those?
Well, thanks, Monica. I mean, I won't go through the history of the ways in which I've been censured by my university, formally by the faculty, and reprimanded through a formal procedure by the university and canceled, and the boycotts against my classes. That's pretty much, anybody can just Google me and see that. But more importantly, you know, I was reading Rand's essay recently, How to Live a Rational Life in an Irrational Society. And that essay really helps me a lot, because what I realize is that you cannot escape moral judgment. And you have to realize that there is something called cultural psychosis. It doesn't mean that everyone in the culture is a psychotic, of course, but it means that it means that there are pervasive beliefs and norms and mores which people mindlessly adhere to or ascribe to, that gives, at least if not the veneer, gives the, it's more than a veneer really, because we see the real suffering of people who are canceled. We see the real suffering of people who are subjected to woke ideology. But first, you asked how I deal with it, and how would I suggest that others deal with it, is to recognize, first of all, that you are dealing with a kind of psychosis. That is a break with, and what do I mean by psychosis? I like to define my terms as I go along because I'm a philosopher. But a person who has the shortest definition, a person who has a complete break with objective reality, whose perceptions are out of alignment with what is real and what is true. So look at racism. One of the reasons I've been able to survive intact psychologically after being the subject of racism from left and the right, as a person of color, is to realize that racism and racists are psychotics. They perceive something about you based on morphological characteristics that have nothing to do with reality. So I think one of the reasons that I can throw my blanket, my cover off every morning, plant my feet on the floor with complete joy to face this chaotic world and not just battle intellectually, but to lead a wonderful personal life and to live happily, is because I realize that the psychotics are not to be taken very, very seriously. I mean, they're to be taken seriously in one respect, they can inflict damage, but never internalize the cultural psychosis as part of your cognitive makeup. So I have a schizophrenic father, which makes life very easy for me and difficult in one respect, who thinks that he's Jesus Christ, who thinks one day that he's a fallen angel. And I had to learn early on as a child how to navigate the madness of a crazy parent. And so, once you don't internalize and think this person really is a spider, you've got to treat them seriously, because if they think they're a spider, they might come after your throat to sting you. But you don't internalize the falsities, you don't internalize the untruths, you don't internalize the dispensation with meaning tests. You certainly don't buy into this new pervading viewpoint that reason and logic are the constructs of racist, white, imperialist European men who devised it to keep people of color outside the domain of the ethical or outside the pantheon of the human community. You realize that all of those things, all of those statements are forms of psychosis. And then you assert what you know is the truth based not just on because you believe it, but by going through rigorous argumentation, marshaling empirical evidence, using reason and logic as the only tools of cognition that are available to the human being as we know so far. And you just use your agency, your creative agency, as both an inoculant against this form of psychosis and also as an elixir, as a panacea against these things. So I'm a teacher. I get papers that have grammatical infelicities in them. I just simply correct them. I don't believe that if someone says Mary and Sally has been walking, that's proper grammar. I just simply, you enforce rules of grammar. You have to use your agency to enforce the truth, not in a subjective, whimsical way, but in an objective, rational way. You just use your agency to fight the psychosis. It's a terrible psychological burden, but the way that I found not to be defeated by it is to first recognize that it is a form of collectivism, it is a form of irrationalism, and in many, many respects, it's a form of psychosis.
Thank you, Professor. I did a room called In Defense of Broccoli, The Bigotry Against Tiny Trees, and I had a counselor come on the stage and criticize me for my racial bigotry. And I'm like, okay, but it helps. You answered both questions in one answer. I'm very impressed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Monica, I'd also share something that's helped me in the past, particularly in work situations where I've had an employee or a colleague who just had hate on me or was making my life very difficult. And my mother, once I tried to turn to her and I said, I don't know what to do with this person. And she said, Jag, you have everything and they have nothing. And I think what she was just pointing me towards was gratitude and understanding that this person, you know, was insecure, was angry, was fearful. And I think that is probably the case with a lot of the cancel culture warriors who, as Ayn Rand said, envy is the hatred of the good for being good. And just, understanding that you have the truth and you have confidence, and you have a community, and you're being productive, that should help. Okay, let's see. Time. Ahlan wa sahlan.
My question is about, it's more like a social philosophy question. I just want to ask Dr. Jason, in the interaction between human groups, or we can call it cultures or nations, do you think that there is a moral code that we can appeal to justify moral judgments about other groups being false or being wrong and other groups of being on groups of being good? And I just want you to clarify where this moral code comes from, if it's and if you agree that there is no wrong or right culture, I want to ask where democracy comes from. If some culture thinks that democracy doesn't fit in its social system, why it is the job of other culture to force it? I just can't understand where this general right or wrong comes from.
Right. Well, thank you, Tim. I'm not a cultural relativist, and I do think that there are universal, unassailable truths and that are indisputable that transcend any one culture and that can be unilaterally applied to culture, to different cultures. Now, where does that come from? Well, it comes from our human nature. So we have a right to our bodily integrity. That is, I have a right not to be harmed by another person because it is a precondition. It actually is a condition for my survival. If anyone has the right to inflict bodily harm on me arbitrarily, then that compromises or that endangers my right to self-preservation. So there are certain moral axioms that I don't need to prove. Subsequent truths are derived from those axioms. One of them is I have the right to self-preservation because that's built into my nature as a human being to preserve my life. And anything that stymies that, anything that compromises that is across the board wrong. Unprovoked infliction of harm or unprovoked violation of my bodily integrity is a wrong. So we can say female genital mutilation, torture, gang rape for women in Pakistan who commit adultery or in some parts of Afghanistan. We can unilaterally say that is a violation of their individual right to their bodily integrity, to their individual right to safeguard their lives as individual human beings. And that's not dependent on the opinion of other people. That's somehow just built into our nature as human beings. And the proper role of the government is to provide the methods or the systems to secure and safeguard those rights. These are not gifts from the government. These are the right of the consent to demand the government, who are servants of the people, going from royal sovereignty to popular sovereignty. They serve our interests. They're there to protect our rights against the encroachment that others would make against us, that would egregiously harm our capacity towards self-preservation, towards the inalienability that is the built-in, unassailable, non-violable right that we have to our own lives, that we are ends in ourselves. And so that's a, you know, that's the first part of where they come from. They come from our nature as human beings. And just like how you have a stomach that has a particular nature, and it is inimical to the ingestion of certain items, like a shark can ingest certain things, like a shoe or a piece of stick. Your stomach has a particular nature, and in order to unilaterally preserve that nature, you'd have to know what nutrients or what things are good that the stomach can digest. If it can't digest it, it's unprocessed food that it vomits back up, or in processed items. It's the same thing with human nature. We have a particular nature. Certain things are inimical to that nature, and certain things are conducive to the flourishing and the maintenance of that nature. And it's a proper role of an individual to understand what human nature consists in, and to rationally adopt principles, ideas, norms that are conducive to the preservation of that nature. Now, the last part of your question about, I wasn't sure about the right of other countries. Were you talking about the right of other countries to interfere in the democratic procedures of a state?
My last question was, if there is a general law of morality that we can appeal to, that yes. means that that means that any culture that does not follow this general law can be forced to follow this general law. It's like, but I have one comment on the saying that these rights follow from the human nature, and as I understand, my stomach nature is and utility is to make me survive. It's a tool for my body system.
That's
so
right.
Yes. So saying that there are certain rights that are there to preserve the human nature or survival. But that raises another question, like if those cultures that follow this unhealthy morality have survived for thousands of years, so that raises the question: how can a culture survive for those and flourish for those thousands of years, following a morality that it is against its nature? So.
I also just want to give a time check because we have 7 more minutes until Professor Hill has to go. So I want to apologize in advance if we're not able to answer all of the questions fully. Jason, did you want to continue on that or get to some of the last?
Yeah. Just briefly, and then we can move on. I would say that, yes, people have survived, but survival is not the same thing as flourishing. And you know, slaves, we had chattel slavery, where people were living under forced condition of labor and servitude. We would not say that they were flourishing. We would just say that they were surviving. And people can live on a subsistence level by adopting bad ideas or ideas that are inimical to their nature. Is it sustainable over a long period of time? I would say the answer is no. And to answer your question about whether or not we can enforce cultures that violate the inalienability of other citizens' rights would take almost an entire session. In short, and then we'll move on, the answer is in moral principle, yes. Whether it's politically expedient for a sovereign nation to do that, if it's not in the national self-interest of its citizens, is a completely different issue.
Okay. Well, in the interest of time, maybe if we could have Henry and then Roger and then Andre just briefly ask their question, because there may be one of those questions that you have more to say about than another, and we'll make a note to also try to circle back with them. I wanted to remind you all we've got two clubhouses next week. Tuesday at the same time, we're going to be talking with our senior fellow, Rob Trusinski, and then Thursday also with Richard Salzman. So, Henry?
Yes. So my question in particular, first off, it's awesome to be able to share the stage with you. My question in particular is in the topic of higher education, especially with the university at the university level. I'm currently a sophomore enrolled at Winthrop University, which is a public liberal arts school in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And I've got a question. So we have a big emphasis, especially in our English sector, in regards to open-mindedness. This is something that our university heavily promotes right now in terms of not only with writing, but also with building our ideologies, our opinions as scholars and throughout our research. This idea that you know, keeping an open mind when looking at different opinions, different ideologies, not allowing certain automatic thinking get in our way of progressing our ideologies, how we take in information from different people and what we do with that information, how we respond to that information. And I'm interested to hear because, you know, I've been really inspired by this idea. I've taken several courses on it. I took a contemporary morals issues course where we discussed major topics, you know, about terrorism, about rights to certain things. And the big idea behind it was keeping an open mind when looking at these questions and looking at these topics. And I want to hear your opinion on the importance of open-mindedness when addressing even very controversial statements, very controversial takes on certain things, whether it be in politics, whether it be in society and religion. And I want to hear really how important you think it is maybe for a university to kind of promote that idea that is open-mindedness. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree with Ayn Rand here. Be careful of having an open mind because you might have trash thrown into it. I would prefer to say I agree with her, have a critical mind. That is, without the issue of context dropping, have a critical mind. That is, when you are open to diverse ideas and beliefs, you always subject them against the backdrop of some meaning test that can adjudicate, again, whether they, among the competing claims, whether they are true or false. To have an uncritical open mind is a very dangerous thing because it means it's a form of relative, it can translate into a form of relativism where you just think, I have an open mind, I'm open to all viewpoints. Some of those viewpoints are less valuable because, again, they're just less, they're untruths, they have not been proven than others. So my recipe for this whole thing is to have a critical mind that is open to a multiplicity of viewpoints, but that is also subjecting them to philosophic meaning tests and judging them according to the criteria of reason, which reason and logic suggest in those moments to get at the truth. But just having an open mind as such, I don't think is a virtue. Having a critical mind, I think, is the way to go.
Thank you for your input.
Roger.
Hi, Jason. Real quick, I have two questions, one personal, one maybe more expansive. But how did you bite your tongue all the way through graduate school and the tenure track process? And what was that like? You may have already answered that, but I would like to hear a little bit. And then second, do you take Trusinski's thought that Kant caused wokeism seriously? If you do, fantastic. If you don't, you're on my side. And anyway, I'd just like to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Roger. I never bit my tongue in graduate school. I've never bit my tongue anywhere at all. I was teaching Ayn Rand. The first time I got my first class as a graduate student, I taught The Verge of Selfishness, much to the chagrin of my professors. And I told them, basically, if you penalize me for this, I'm going to sue you. I was a very, very obstreperous child. Even as an adult. So I never bit my tongue in graduate school because I just always would say, define what you mean. Define what you mean. If you think Ayn Rand is a monster, define monster. Show me ostensibly the things that she's done in her life to destroy people's lives. So I never bit my tongue. And no, I don't think that Kant, this is ridiculous. I don't think that Kant is the godfather of wokeism. I mean, I think the kind of epistemological processes that you'd have to go through is a far stretch. It's just too far for me. I'm not willing to go that route.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful to hear that, Jason. Thank you.
Right. And an example of one of the defining characteristics of the Atlas Society is that we have scholars and fellows who can disagree broadly within the tent of objectivism and appreciating and studying and communicating Ayn Rand's ideas. So, Jason, you have to run? Jason, do you have to run?
I can take one more question.
All right, let's make it short because I have to run. Andre.
Awesome. I'm going to try to speak very fast because I just wanted to qualify something. So it seems that one of the, and first of all, thank you so much, Dr. Hill. Like, really appreciate everything that you are doing and have done so far. But so it seems to be one of the features of the democratic system, and I would argue it's a feature, not the bug, is the fact that, you know, the course of direction of the society, the progress, is determined not by the majority necessarily, but the loudest, the most motivated group and the loudest speaking, like the group that speaks the loudest. So to counter that political and social movement that is composed of mostly of zealots, and, you know, zealots, when dealing with zealots, you know, like you're dealing with people who are willing to go through great sacrifices in terms of their time and energy. And I think John McWhorter made a fabulous point with his latest book about, you know, kind of determining it as a quasi-religious cult with wokeism. How do you deal with those people who are willing to go to great lengths to drive their point? And, you know, if majority of the people who understand what's happening, but they might not have the same type of time or energy in order to counter it. And the second part of the question is, like, it seems that, you know, there was great work that was done by, like, Dr. Hicks and Dr. Lindsay and Dr. Boghossian in terms of exposing the belly of the beast in terms of what we're dealing with epistemically and you know, culturally and historically, like where all of those things come from. So how, like, what kind of an coherent alternative can we provide to, you know, like the host of critical theories that are inspired by Marcuse and Gramsci's methodology and using postmodern tools to dismantle what we have right now and impose some sort of new social order? Because it seems like the new wave of classical liberalism would be the answer, but there needs to be some sort of sexier version of it that needs to come.
All right, so we have to be brief here. I would simply say that, you know, diagnosis is not enough. One has to diagnose the problem, and one can diagnose the problem by asking people always to define their terms and walk around with a little pocket dictionary or with your telephone and say, okay, so what do you mean by this? You'd be surprised at how people are so sloppy in their, conceptually sloppy in their usage of terms. They don't know half the time the terms that they're using by which they indict other people. So ask them to define their terms. You make a diagnosis. But also, I think the proper solution is to provide a solution, to provide an alternative. It's not just enough to diagnose and expose the belly of the beast. One has to come up with an alternative. And the alternative is always going to be some kind of truth based on objective reality that you can ostensibly point to that will demolish their arguments, demolish their positions. If this is done consistently, indefatigably, by a number of people, then we can change a cultural trend. So analyses, diagnoses, these things are all fine. Getting people to define their terms, which will silence many of them immediately, because you catch them in a conceptual conundrum where they're twisting themselves into these conceptual pretzels and they can't get out. So I always tell people, what do you mean by this? What, define your terms. Define that term. Use a big word. Define it. Don't look in a dictionary. Define it. You used it. That will shut them up. But that's not enough, because they'll go ahead and use it, you know, against some person who's not as, might not be as rigorous as we are. But then consistently providing a solution, alternative. One has to provide an alternative to the mess and the junk that's out there. And that's more important. I think that's more important, providing an alternative, a solution, which is always going to be grounded in reality and which you can show ostensibly is conducive to our nature as free, rational creatures that need not only survive, but we need to flourish and sustain our virtues over time, sustain those virtues that are conducive to flourishing over a protracted period of time, that we're future-oriented creatures. We're not range-of-the-moment, concrete-bound creatures. We're future-oriented creatures who have to sustain our lives over a long period of time, and those virtues and values that are conducive to that protracted period of time.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you, everyone. Excellent questions, excellent conversation today. Please follow us on all of our social platforms, but if, in terms of questions and answers, on Instagram, as I mentioned, we do have the guest takeovers twice a week. So the quality of questions we're getting here is really impressive. So I'd love to bring some of those onto the Instagram platform. So that would be Atlas Society on Instagram. And come back and join us next week on Tuesday, again, talking with Rob Trusinski, Thursday with Richard Salzman. And thanks, everybody, for a great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Jennifer. Bye.